You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. President Joe Biden says he does not regret his decision to withdraw the U.S. military from Afghanistan, though in an address to the nation yesterday, he said he was deeply saddened by the facts we now face. Today, we're going to talk about some of those facts and provide a little context for how we got here. Lieutenant Colonel Ben Jones served in Afghanistan twice, first as an advisor at the National Military Academy of Afghanistan in 2009, and later as a member of the Strategic Transition and Assessment Group. That was from 2011 to 2012. Jones is now retired from the U.S. Air Force. He holds a Ph.D. in history, and he currently serves as South Dakota's state historian. He agreed to stop by the STPB Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls to talk about some of that experience. Dr. Jones, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks.
The collapse of the Afghan government and military, the coalition, came more quickly than the Biden administration anticipated, is what the president said to us yesterday. But in many years, the collapse really could have been predicted. Yes? No?
Well, a lot of things could have been predicted, I guess. I think one of the, when we think about planning military operations and the conduct of war and so forth, one of the things that your leaders should be concerned about is something called the center of gravity, which is something that if taken apart by the enemy, then your ability to operate is diminished. General Allen, who I worked for at one of those jobs in Afghanistan, was the commander of ISAF forces in Afghanistan in 2011. He took over in June of 2011. He said early on in his tenure that the center of gravity for us was the coalition itself, was our relationship within NATO partners and those non-NATO members who were bringing troops and support to Afghanistan, as well as that there should not be any daylight between the coalition and the Afghan government. And when there was noticeable differences between the two, that those should be hashed out in private and that we should not, that should not be exposed because the Taliban could take advantage of that, that they can see, oh, there's a distinction between what the coalition is saying or what the United States is saying and what the Afghan government is saying or able to do, and that they could, in the expression, there should be no daylight, they could drive a freight train through there and exploit that. I found it very odd then, personally, to be watching the Obama administration at the time attempt to unilaterally negotiate with the Taliban, even secretly in a third country, to be negotiating with them tells the Taliban that, the Afghan government isn't here at the table. It's just the two of us, the United States and the Taliban, and we'll work out a deal and we'll tell the government later. That's daylight that you can drive a train through. And I think so that, in my view, set up the long train of events that the Taliban continued to exploit since 2011-12 when those negotiations started.
There were always different goals for the transition. The transition itself has been planned for some time, but people were coming at this from different goals. And you write about this in a chapter in the book, Our Latest Longest War. I think it was the first time I ever interviewed you was about this book or perhaps about your own book on Eisenhower's guerrillas. But you say from the beginning, they did not have the same goals.
Right.
How so? Explain that.
Well, in I think it must have been November or so of 2010, a NATO conference in, I think it was Lisbon. Yes, the Lisbon conference decided that it would be a conditions-based withdrawal. And what that means is as the Afghan forces are able to take over the war, that the coalition would recede, and that we set up, or that was concluded within the coalition then in November of 2010. When I arrived in the winter of 2011, that capability, that small organization of planners inside of General Petraeus' headquarters was just getting going, and and I was joining that team, and we set up kind of the definitions, we came to terms, we met with the Afghan generals and senior police leaders frequently to kind of understand the realities on the ground. So when we said conditions-based. We came up with a common understanding and framework of what those conditions would be, understanding that the timeline was that the Afghans would be in charge everywhere, but that the support for them would continue based on conditions. That fell apart that summer when, and Secretary Gates writes about this in his book, and then I use that for the source in my chapter, that it was very evident to me that there was differences of understanding between the embassy across the street from where we were in Kabul, with the White House, with the things that the National Security Council would say to us, with other allies and how they understood that what conditions-based meant. And ultimately by June, when President Obama told General Petraeus in a meeting in the White House, I mean, I wasn't there for that, but General Petraeus shared that with the rest of us later that day. Over a teleconference, that conditions-based, essentially, he didn't put it this way, he was far more diplomatic, but essentially was the calendar. And that all forces would be out by the end of 2014. So if that's what it means, then the ability of the Afghan government to take over and for the Afghan army to fight the war really was not a tremendous concern of the United States government. It was, we're going to get out of here.
Yeah. President Obama wanted the U.S. military out of Afghanistan. President Trump wanted the U.S. Mm-hmm. military out of Afghanistan. President Biden wants the U.S. military out of Afghanistan.
Yep.
Do we have a U.S. interest in Afghanistan, in your opinion? I mean, I know that's three presidents and one retired lieutenant colonel speaking on that. But what can you add to that dialogue as far as, like, is it that, yes, we do need to get out and it was just a matter of time before somebody had to do this? Or do we still have interests there and this really should have been handled differently is what I'm trying to get
well,
at.
Well, when you think about with us gone now, Pakistan next door is a nuclear proliferator and they are emboldened and strengthened with us gone. So is that a good thing for the United States? I don't think so. The terrorist networks now are in high recruit mode bragging about what's going on in Kabul right now and in Kandahar and all over. And their social media and getting the word out, they're going to make hay for this for decades. So that's not good for the United States. Okay. So I would think that some other path to a lessening of the presence while maintaining something there to support the Afghan National Army in its fight against the Taliban would have been preference, in my opinion.
President Biden had some strong words for about the Afghan government, the Afghan military not willing. Why should American soldiers, why should American military members stand up for people who are not willing to stand up to themselves? That struck me personally as a very strong thing to say. You worked with a lot of these people.
Mm-hmm.
Did that, and I guess I can find my direct quote, but did that sort of tone that he took yesterday hit you in the same way that it was sort of hitting me, this almost accusation?
It's an accusation which over the past few weeks probably needs some explain. Well, I don't know why they haven't been fighting in the last few weeks because for the last several years they've been taking thousands of casualties every year.
Mm-hmm.
So the accusation that the ANA won't fight over the past several years is just wrong. The question is, why did they give up in the last several weeks? I don't know the answer to that, but I was very disappointed in the president's comment about that yesterday. The accusatory tone, I thought, was unfounded.
Sounds like daylight to me, too.
Yes.
Again, that's a little editorializing there on my part, but I guess would you call that daylight would be the question. Like him saying that about the government of Afghanistan, does that tell other organizations something about American foreign policy that could seem like daylight is a better question.
You could certainly interpret it that way.
What can you tell me about this evacuation process? Because it seems like a huge humanitarian crisis just emerging in front of us and people on the ground who are trying to evacuate, find planes, move equipment.
Yeah.
people hanging off of American aircraft.
Sure. Well,
painful to watch.
Yeah.
How does it land with you?
I have in the past also been a part of planning and then also in the operations of what's in military terms called a non-combatant evacuation operation, a NEO. These things are always very complex because you never really know what to expect when you get there. But one of the things that you have to make some assumptions, and one of the assumptions that one might make if you're planning one of these things is that the host country has the security for the airport taken care of. And by the looks of it on TV, it appears that that was an assumption that was holding until probably the airplanes landed. The Afghan army had the security of the airport taken care of. What does that mean? Well, that means that you don't have to check IDs at the plane. You're just loading the people that the Afghan government and the embassy has said are cleared to get on. But what we're seeing now is, at least in the first several hours of this, was people rushing the plane and aircrew making decisions based on just looking at the person and their state and trying to assess whether they could get on the aircraft or not. I mean, they are put in a very awful situation. One of the NEO that I was involved in, the passengers we were loading on were embassy staff and third country nationals that had approval to be there by the U.S. ambassador. So we didn't have to make that call. I can't imagine being a captain or a major aircrew commander and making the call with 640 people, which evidently is the photograph that I've seen on one C-17 to fly them out. You know, you check them for security reasons and you put them on if you have the time to do that. I don't know how the frenetic pace. It's not what one would plan to do. And so you're doing it on the fly.
Do you have friends, colleagues, people that you know of that you suspect are left behind and unable to evacuate whose lives may be at risk now with the Taliban in charge?
Sure. I worked with several Afghan officers and police leadership, and I've tried to contact them. I heard from one Saturday evening over a LinkedIn instant message,
right.
if you can believe it. But I haven't heard from them since. I had another interpreter who's now in this country. He's got a green card and lives in the United States, and he's trying to get his parents and his brothers and sisters out. So they're in Kabul, and when I checked with him this morning, they seemed, as far as he knew, they were okay, but they're staying in their house.
This is another question that's maybe an unfair one, but there are a lot of veterans living in this state, probably listening right now, who served in Afghanistan or in Iraq, and this is incredibly personal mm-hmm. for them as well. Anything you want to say to them as someone who has been there yourself, watching this unfold, how do veterans process this time?
I would just say that veterans, since the dawn of time, have reflected on their war service in a very personal way, and those ways have been the most rewarding. So contact your fellows in arms that you served with and make sure they're okay. I've been contacted by friends in New Zealand and Australia and England and around the country as well, and I appreciate that. And so I would just continue that. And I would also say that, for 20 years, we showed them, the Afghan people, what the possibilities were. And I think that's something that we can be proud of. And we also, the United States and the coalition, prevented an attack like 9/11 from happening again. It's hard to prove the negative, but we can also take some comfort in that.
Dr. Ben Jones, I want to say thank you for being here today,
sure.
Sharing a little bit of a personal story and giving us some context as well. I appreciate your time.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.